You're listening to The Dirt on the Past, a show on history and archaeology and why it matters today. You can find us on the Extreme History Project website and also on kgbm.org. Thanks for listening. Welcome to The Dirt on the Past from the Extreme History Project and KGBM Community Radio.
Whether digging up a site or dusting off the archives, we bring you some of the most fascinating and cutting-edge research in history and archaeology, and discuss why it matters today. Join me, Nancy Mahoney, alongside co-host Crystal Alegria, as we converse with anthropologists, archaeologists,
and historians about how they bring the past alive.
Welcome to this week's edition of the show. I'm Nancy.
And I'm Crystal.
And we're the co-hosts of The Dirt on the Past. This week, we are at the KGVM headquarters speaking via Zoom with Dr. Lily White about her work as a forensic anthropologist. And we are super excited to talk with Lily today. She is really fun to listen to because we have listened to some of her other podcasts. But before we do that, Crystal, I want to check in. How was your week?
It was great. It is Halloween. We're coming up to Halloween, so
And you have beautiful black nail polish on your acrylic nails, and I'm super jealous.
I do. Yeah. I haven't done acrylic nails for years. I haven't done them since I got married, which was many years ago. So
I know you were spying mine when I went to New York.
Yeah.
I know, and now I'm jealous that mine are gone.
Me.
Yes.
Yeah. So you and my daughter. So Emily has the most beautiful hands. And she has the most beautiful nails. Her nails are always done beautifully. So I'm like, I want to do that. So I did it.
And Halloween's the perfect. Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. So it's been a good week because we have spent a lot of time in the cemetery. Which you know how much I love the cemetery. So.
Not for a personal loved one, but for visits for historic
reasons.
Okay.
Yes,
Excellent.
And so, so we've been doing a lot of cemetery tours, and which has been great. And we've had so many people interested in our cemetery tours this year. So,
such a fun way to learn about history.
Yeah,
it's awesome.
We've been in there. So, what about you, Nancy?
Well, I spent a good chunk of last week in Boise. My daughter was looking at Boise State, so I was actually there when we recorded our last podcast with Ellen Baumler, and we loved it there. Boise has a lot of interesting history, and it's on display everywhere. So they have a lot of museums and trails and parks named after particularly historical women. So there was a lot about it that I really liked there, a lot of historic core to their downtown. So I see a road trip in our future, Crystal, to maybe go over there.
Yeah.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's awesome food and places to stay and good shopping, just as icing on the cake.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
Then aside from that, I've had actually three former students are all applying to go back to grad school in anthropology or archaeology this fall. And it's so exciting and fun to be able to help them onto that next step. They've all taken various amounts of time off, kind of figured out exactly what they think they want to do. And I'm helping them with just advice about putting together a statement of purpose and visiting people ahead of time and just a chance to put their best foot forward as they're applying.
That's
and other
great.
Than that, yeah, it's been at the store yet another remodel. With Handy Andy.
The remodel sagas continue.
Yeah, this time, beautiful handmade tile from the Onyx Tile Studio here in Bozeman. And then Cheryl Hendry's husband, Andy Marshall, putting in the tile. Beautiful job. I feel like it complements the historic building that I'm in. So that's been really exciting. And he put some old patinaed copper along with it. So I'm excited about that. Again, it was a little bit exhausting. And then next week, I'm off to England, and I'm going to see some amazing historic places there. My sister is turning a certain age, and I am going to be there to celebrate with her, and I'm bringing Kaylee. So so that's what's going on in my week. And
you got a big week.
I got a big week. I've had a big week. I'm going to have a big week.
You are.
And we should get back to Lily. Before we do that, we just want to say who our sponsor is for this episode.
Yeah, so our sponsor for this episode is the Western Heritage Center. So we'll talk a little bit more about them as we go forward. So we are so glad to have you with us today, Lily.
Welcome, Lily.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to start off, as we always do, by telling our listeners a little bit about you. So Dr. Lily White received her BSLS in 2005 from MSUB. and her bachelor's in forensic anthropology in 2011, her master's in forensic anthropology in 2013, and her PhD in anthropology in 2019 from the University of Montana. That is a lot of degrees, Lily. Wow, you've been through it. Lily and her husband, Stocky White, also a PhD in anthropology, are the owners of Bone and Stone Anthrosciences, LLC, where they provide anthropological and archaeological consulting services and other educational workshops. Between 2015 and 2018, Lily created and facilitated a medico-legal death investigation conference at the University of Montana, perhaps the first of its kind, where she provided continuing education to hundreds of attendees. She is a medical investigator with the Department of Health and Human Services and Natural Disaster Medical System. She has worked as an adjunct instructor at the University of Montana, teaching fundamentals of forensic science. She's also an instructor for Tri-Tech Forensics Training, as well as working with Kenyan International Emergency Services as an FAC/SAT member. And you will have to explain what those acronyms mean as we go further into the podcast. Lily teaches courses on a variety of subjects, including cultural and forensic anthropology, human osteology, death notification interactions, including compassion fatigue and vicarious trauma, human decomposition, recovery of scattered human remains and burials, cold and current death investigations and case reviews, as well as grief facilitation, dark tourism, and I can't believe it, but even other fascinating topics. So this is a pretty amazing and interesting resume, and I think we have a million questions that we're going to have for you today, Lily. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks.
So, Lily, we always start off by asking our guests how they got into the field of archaeology, anthropology, forensic anthropology in your case. And I know you came to this a little bit later in life. And so I'm curious how you found yourself in this field.
Well, I've always been fascinated with death, but I didn't ever see it as a career. When I went right out of high school, I went to beauty school. And right after that, quickly after that, I opened my own salon and owned my salon for 20 years. And I got in a car accident, and that sort of took me out of commission as far as doing hair. And I didn't have anything to fall back on, so it freaked me out. So I decided I was going to go, you know, do kind of a quick and dirty degree because I didn't have any education besides beauty school. And so I went back to school, or I went to school at MSU, and I was so intimidated by the process. I was 38 or right around there. I was intimidated by the process. So I just chose communication and, you know, just started through it. And it was pretty funny because I wanted it to be easy. And so the A's were coming easy and everything was coming easy. And finally, my advisor called me out, Melinda Tilton, and she said, "Now, do you want this to be easy or do you want it to be challenging?" Yeah. And I said, "Well,
you're like, I want a job after this, yeah, ultimately, right, and probably yeah, for it to be easy."
Yeah. Right, right. That was the easy answer. And she said, "Why don't you challenge yourself? And why don't you do something else? Or, you know, what other interests you have?" And you know, just trying to bring this out of me. And she said, "Are you doing anything like in school right now that's interesting?" And I said, "Yeah, actually, I'm taking a class from Dr. Dave Karnos, and it was called Death, Dying, and Medical Ethics. And it was every provocative subject to do with death, dying, and medical ethics. It was assisted euthanasia, abortion, death penalty. And it was just such a stimulating class that I thought, well, I could sort of sidle into that and, you know, see how that works out. And so what I ended up doing was creating myself sort of a different studies, internships. And so I worked with, you know, hospice and Life Center Northwest, sort of organ procurement. And then I landed on a coroner internship. And just for about a year, from 2004 to 2005, I followed around Yellowstone County coroners for that year. Wow. And just sort of shouted them and you know,
what an amazing experience that must have been, Lily. I took a death and dying course as an undergraduate at Emory, but I was kind of too young to imagine it. And I was getting an anthropology degree, but I didn't quite make the connection. And it's so interesting to see, as you went back, you know, at a different age with a different view on things, how you were able to say, oh, boy, this really has some potential to be a career and not just a passing interest, you know, in ethics.
Going into it, I was thinking, well, maybe I could run for coroner, you know, and so that was angled into that. And I thought, well, let me see if I can handle it first. And as it turns out, you know, I was that kid that preferred macabre over, you know, mundane. And so, you know, I always preferred the Addams Family or the Munsters over the, you know, Brady Bunch. So it turns out I was able to handle sort of the gore and things like that. But what I found really fascinating was the human part of it. And I, you know, sort of finished up that degree pretty quickly and then knew that what I wanted to do with that was I didn't know enough about the body or what happens to the body, you know, before, during, and after death. So in order to even, you know, run for coroner or be a coroner, I just thought, well, now I have to know forensic anthropology.
And so I would have thought even like, do you have to have a medical degree? And I was listening to one of your podcasts where you're saying, especially in Montana, that's not necessarily what it takes to be a coroner. If you don't have to have a medical degree, there are other positions as coroner that's not required.
Right. In Montana, you're required to, the main coroners are elected.
Okay.
And then they can deputize coroners and then so they can have several different deputy coroners, but they're not required to have a medical degree. But what they're required to do is do a 40-hour course on, you know, coroner training. Mm-hmm. And then every 2 hours, they have to do 16 hours of continuing ed. But that's not what I wanted. I wanted to know if I was going to go and investigate deaths, then I want to know what is that body doing?
Right.
Why is it in that place? Or I wanted to know what happens when someone's shot, what happens when someone's stabbed, you know? I wanted to know what happens to that body. And then I also wanted to know how to interact with scenes. And so I wanted the additional degree. And
there's a huge science of forensic investigation. That's sort of the investigating part. And then also the science, as you said, of the body. So that would have been an interesting thought to be like, what do I go next to get my training? So you felt it took you to forensic anthropology.
I did. I felt like initially it took me to forensic anthropology. And that took me to sort of decomposition studies and forensic entomology and what happens to bodies in Montana as opposed to the South.
Yeah, different conditions.
Different places. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up sort of doing an internship and some other, it was a sort of a field school at one of the body farms.
Oh, I was going to say, did you go? Yeah. You went to a body farm?
Yeah, that's amazing.
Because when I tell people these places exist, they're like, what? Because people who are interested are really interested. And that's where they're doing that real work of looking at decomposition kind of under controlled circumstances, but outside in various weather and soil conditions. It's amazing.
Yep. Yeah. And so it, you know, you end up that I did that during my master's research. And so that was sort of in the middle of that. I moved from once I got my master's with, I did decomp and it had an element of forensic entomology. Then it was sort of, my mind had wrapped up around like, it's like, okay, I've got that part. Yeah. Now I want the social part of dying.
What do you mean by that, Lily?
Well, I wanted to look at the tension between the biological death and the social death. Mm. And so, it was easy to do, like easy for me and easy for people to have, like understand biological death or, you know, your body or the case becomes an it. It becomes science. Mm. And so you sort of, at death scenes or things like that, your mind isn't on family, you know, the emotional part or the social part of death. And so it was really interesting during my my master's research. I went to a lot of coroner conferences, and I would go to advanced coroner trainings. And they would let me in as the non-coroner because I was a forensic anthropologist. And we would have these conversations, and I would say to them, what do you need from me? Like, what would you need from a forensic anthropologist? And they said, well, of course, you know, to help us with the bones and help us with, you know, what are we seeing here or whatever. But they said, honestly, we could really use some help on cultural and how to deal with families, because we're lacking big time in that. And so I just sort of let them guide me because I felt like they were going to be my client.
So Lily, was it the 40-hour training? It didn't really include for them a component of dealing with families and notification and grief and that sort of aspect. The 40-hour training was more about maybe legally what they had to do, or...
Yeah, and it ended up, there's such a broad, they have to study so much during sort of that 40-hour death death training that it covers everything from, you know, how to call a death and just sort of toxicity levels. There's just so much in it that they barely sweep by that portion. And, you know, they just didn't have time for it. And a lot of like the death, the different, like I went to St. Louis and they had a, it was medical legal death, training. And so I did their 40 hour thing at the time, and they didn't have any death notification. You know, it's just, they barely scratched the surface on it. Now they have more. So I noticed their curriculum now for the 40 hours, and there's a little bit more, but there's just so much to cover in that short amount of time for them that it's just not what they cover. They don't cover the human part of it. They don't cover the emotional and actually, like, so many of them said to me, this is so hard on me. This is,
I can't,
you know,
imagine.
Yeah. And
not,
you know,
to have
they
any
just
training in that or any, you know, real help with that would be really,
well, and
hard.
A lot of them tend to be, a lot of the coroners tend to be, like law enforcement, things like that. So they're not trained to have that emotional side to them. And so it's, you know, this is my job. This is what I need to do. I need to keep it together. And so they're like, this is it, but it's hard.
Yeah.
A lot of them would, you know, some of the people wear two hats. They'll go to a death scene or a crime scene, and they'll be, you know, dealing with the body or whatever, and then they'll have to go immediately afterwards to a death notification. And they're like, I can smell it, you know, I can see it, and I can feel it, and then I have to go to the really, really emotional part of informing family. So, you know, they just said, help, help.
Yeah.
So that sort of became my mission, is to figure out how to help.
Well, we want to get a little bit into the fact that you have a PhD in forensic anthropology. You pursued that at a master's and PhD level. And as we know, anthropology is a four-field discipline. We have cultural anthropology, archaeology, linguistics, and then really physical anthropology. And then within physical anthropology, we have sort of this subdiscipline of forensics. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about two things, really. What your specialty has become in, or was maybe for your doctoral dissertation in forensic anthropology, and then what it's like. I mean, we all have ideas from TV shows, but what it's like in real life to be a forensic anthropologist, a day in the life, so to speak.
Okay. Well, basically, forensic anthropology is the scientific study of human skeletal remains in a medical legal sense. And so what we do as forensic anthropologists, for the most part, what I do is I get calls to look at cases. I get calls to help find bodies. I get calls to help do identifications of people, usually through skeletal remains. And so that's a big portion of what I do when I get cases from different, I get a lot of different states, Florida, Idaho, Colorado, different people will either ask me to come out and take a look, or I'll just they'll send me the case. And so what I end up doing is looking at a portion of it and just sort of giving my opinion on what happened. Most of the time it'll be going over the skeletal remains and looking for injuries or, you know, any obvious injuries, things like that. So I help in that way. I also sort of work with a multidisciplinary team. I have some great people that I work with that are crime scene investigators, forensic pathologists, people like that. So we just sort of collaborate together and work together, and we give workshops on that. I just gave a workshop with another forensic anthropologist, Dr. Hillary Parsons. We did that in Albany, New York, and we're going to do one here at the first week of December in San Diego. And so what we do is present, like this one coming up will be a 5-day course on osteology, forensic taphonomy, forensic entomology, how to recover, document, and collect the human remains from scatter or buried remains. So that's sort of what I do.
Who shows up to those workshops that you do? Is it law enforcement, students? Is it a wide array of different types of people?
It's been more law enforcement because that's who I have been doing it for, this Tri-Tech Forensics. And so they have more relationships with law enforcement, CSI, like the New York, the Albany group were New York troopers. And so San Diego will be a police department, CSI. So that type of group. So more law enforcement and students, you know, if they want to do it, you know, it just depends on what they need. So it ends up being law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Mostly. So what did you do for your PhD, Lily? What was your PhD research?
It was death notification interactions. So I did basically an ethnography of death notification interactions because I wanted, I was basically looking for the power in the narrative. And I wanted to tell the story of both sides. I wanted to tell the notifier's side, and I also wanted to tell the people being notified. And so I observed and interviewed both notified and the next of kin and the people that were notifying. And so I wanted them to tell me what it was like, and I wanted to share their stories. And I wanted a lot of the courses that are out there on death notifications are a how-to. Mm-hmm. Here's the steps that you go through to you know, deliver a death notification. Well, they've become, you know, quite structured and quite rigid, and so, but not all that realistic. And so what I wanted to do is I want to start sharing more about letting people know that they're very unique. Each one is different, and you can't, there's not a script. You can't go with a script. So, yeah. You know, not they're a formula. Not cookie cutter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting, right, that right. This seems to be kind of not a course that you would normally take yourself in a forensics program. Mm-hmm. So you were really seeking this out on your own.
Yes. And it was sort of half of my trouble even going through college was I'm old enough to know what I want. Yeah. And I'm stubborn enough to stick in that, to sit in that spot and sort of argue about what I want and what I wanted for kind of humankind. Yeah. And the weird part was the forensic anthropologists were like, well, you don't really fit in our group with that. And then the cultural anthropologists, they're like, well, aren't you a forensic anthropologist? So you know, I felt like I did this dissertation sort of in that tension between the two. And so I really felt like I was, you know, sort of bringing it into anthropology. And it was interesting because several of my people on my committee said, you know, how is this anthropological? And I said, how is it not anthropological?
Right. It's all about human interaction.
And you're combining two subdisciplines, as you said. I mean, right. it's about doing an ethnography in the context of death and dying, but also in this medical legal field, and really for people who haven't had that opportunity to have that work done. That sounds fascinating and good for you for bullying your way into it. That's awesome.
Yeah. And I wanted to I wanted to contribute to the anthropology of death in a more, you know, sort of contemporary way. And I wanted to take, you know, sort of the anthropology of death out of the exotic and put it into the mundane, you know, and I wanted to say this, you know, this isn't sexy and this isn't exotic. This is everyday happening, but we are anthropologists and we should be able to handle this. Right. And so it was really interesting too, that ending up doing this ethnography, because when I did the internship, all those years ago, 2004 to 2005, I was actually doing an ethnography.
You were doing participant observation, which is classic ethnographic method. Absolutely.
Right, right. And even, you know, to the point of interviewing, you know, and you know, the talking afterwards and watching and sitting through it. And one of the things that got me into the death notification was that I had an experience during the coroner internship with the deputy coroner, and I went with him everywhere. He had been in the deputy coroner for about 27 years, and I went with him on one of our death notifications, and he always did a really great job. And so we went in, he did the death notification, we walked out, and he said, "Well, I blew that.
Oh, boy.
I blew it." And it just sort of stopped me in my tracks, and I said, "Oh, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think you did great." And he said, "No, I did. I blew it." Mm-hmm. And it wasn't my perception, but it was his perception. Mm. And then I sat with it a few minutes, and I thought, well, if that's his perception, what was their perception?
Right.
And so that always stuck with me. And it was, you know, it was something that kind of sat back in my head. And it was sort of one of those research questions that always kind of annoyed me back here, even doing my forensic anthropology part of it. I was always like, I'm getting back there.
It's so interesting because it's such a pivotal moment in people's lives that they'll never forget, is when they heard that information. And in there's such an emotional imprint that even sometimes the exact words will be burned in, sometimes not. It's just the feeling or the impression. But it's not a moment anyone will ever forget. And to have that responsibility. It must have been amazing to watch that and to watch someone who'd been doing it for 27 years, but feel like sometimes he still might have not gotten it right. So I can see how that became a focus for you. That's amazing.
And you know, what a gift for those coroners to be able to come to a workshop that you provide and learn. You know, they probably all want to learn how to do that one particular part of their job better, because that's such an important part. And so what a important service to provide them with more information on how to do that through your research. So
I had a lot of them thank me for doing it. They said, "Duh.
Yeah, I can
imagine.
What
a relief that you're doing this, and to let people know that this isn't easy for us either."
Right. And it can also be so lonely, I think, if you don't have you've created, through your trainings, I'm sure, quite a community of people for which they can hear other experiences and feel like they're part of a larger community doing this work.
So, Nancy, did you want to follow up with anything else on that question, or should we move forward?
No, I think we can move forward.
Okay. So, you know, we kind of, Nancy and I kind of live in the past. You live in the present.
But I live in the past, too.
You do.
Yeah.
But, yeah. You know, we kind of look at things historically. And so oftentimes, you know, we're looking at death historically and looking at people's lives, but oftentimes their death, because their death is when we get records of these people. This, you know, the death is when we find out the most information about people through their death certificates, through their obituaries, through their, you know, their deed records when they die, who they're giving their land and property to. So, you know, we kind of live in that realm. And it's so interesting. Sometimes we get these little glimmers of information about how people in the past dealt with death. And sometimes we get more than glimmers. Sometimes we get a lot of information about how people dealt with death. And it seems like people in the past were so much more engaged in the death of their family member and then the aftermath of that death, where they would wash the body, they would prepare the body. There was rituals involved in all of that. There was time to mourn. There was customs around mourning. And we still have some of those things today in the present, I would say. But in American culture, I feel like, though, a lot of those customs have been let go, that we don't have those, that we are not as close to death as people in the past were. And we've handed a lot of those things off to undertakers and morticians and other people who are professionals in the field of dealing with death and dying of loved ones. And so I just wanted your take on this, because I think about this a lot, and I talk to people about this all the time and wonder about this. But I wanted, you know, your thoughts on this. And if we are distancing ourselves from death, what are the implications of that for our society today?
Yeah, great comments, great question. I think I'll start with sort of part one of that. And in my mind, I feel like we are sanitizing death. Mm. And, you know, and that could have come when people couldn't deal with bodies, with plagued bodies or smallpox or things like that, where they couldn't actually deal with their family members or whatever. So I feel like when, you know, someone's dying at home or whatever, their first instinct is to rush them off to the hospital. So people, instead of dying at homes, they're dying in institutions, hospitals, things like that. And so it's sort of, I feel like it's sort of sanitizing death. And it is truly, I believe it is distancing people from death. And, you know, it's interesting because during my dissertation, out of the, you know, people talking and, you know, sort of this ethnography, is I came up with what I refer to as distance management theory, and that people actually will not necessarily even knowingly, but they'll distance themselves from death, either physically or emotionally. And sometimes that's how we have to handle it. So I see that happening just because it's maybe too much and it becomes okay, like culturally okay, to distance yourself from death. And so that, I found that part really fascinating. And that truly, I think people are distancing themselves from death. And what's really been fascinating, I'm driving back into current, is sort of the COVID deaths. And what's happening is, you know, we weren't necessarily distancing ourselves because we wanted to, but because out of necessity. So, you know, these people were not able to have really funerals, they were doing funerals from Zoom funerals. And so it started taking the personal element out of it. And then I don't know if you guys have noticed, I'm sure you have, but, you know, sort of obituaries have gotten shorter. Memorial services, you know, I don't know what percentage anymore of the people that pass away are not having services. Mm-hmm. No services at this time. Right, you know, a service will be in the future sometime. And you know, the obituaries are getting smaller, and sort of the you know, last celebration of death is getting smaller and smaller. And so I can't help but, you know, recognize that and see that additional distancing. And then politicizing death. You know, this whole, you know, this whole COVID death. I mean, did we ever in our country think we were going to get over 700,000 deaths and then have people just act like it's nothing? Or here in Montana, we've had 2,300 deaths and people are just like, what?
And people are dying alone without their family around them because they're not allowed to have anyone in. I think unless it really happens to you or someone close to you, it still feels distant, you know?
Yeah.
So it's not happening in our neighborhoods, which I feel like is kind of what you're saying, Crystal. It's happening in an institution, as you said. And so it's physically removed. And then it does seem to me like these memorial services are also then temporarily removed, right? We're not celebrating people until a while after. So people aren't showing that raw emotion at that time. You're not dealing with burying a body at that time or cremating someone. So there is a lot of distancing going on, it seems like, in our current culture here in the States. Yeah.
And I sort of worry about, because even the distancing just from that death, are we distancing ourselves from grief?
Right.
And are we delaying our grief? And that's scary too, because what happens to it when it, you know, grief is bottled up? So if you can't, part of the ritual of death is the mourning and the crying and the hugging and the laughter. And if we're distancing from that, we're not getting that. Mm-hmm. And so that worries me. And, I'm worried how casual it's becoming. And, in the same vein, you know, we all know that death is universal, that it happens to everyone, but to sort of lose the celebration of death, is sad. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's sort of celebrating a person's life, and now it's becoming just sort of no big deal. So I worry about those things. I worry about the grieving process, whether people are truly grieving, you know, without your friends and family and your community, is there true grieving, or your grief is alone and that you're not able to share your grief? And so I worry about that. I look at the, you know, suicides. There have been, even in my little community of Big Fork, there've been a lot of young suicides, and you wonder if people are properly grieving or if the kids are understanding. And there's a lot.
If grief is shared, there's more sharing that burden. And you're right, that loneliness. When my own parents have passed away, both of them, and being from an Irish Catholic upbringing, they both had wakes and funerals. And these both happened just within a year of each other. And they were buried right next to each other. But what I remember was it felt like so much to plan it. But then when it was happening, either the wakes allowed you to be in the presence of the body and talk with people. And I learned so many things about my parents. You know, I learned so many things from people who knew them at all these other parts of their life before I was ever alive. And those are the things that have stuck with me. And then we did have the, you know, the formal mass and the burial. And there is a lot about that ritual that comforts me now to have gone through that and to be able to share that and to see who showed up. There was a lot about that I didn't realize how much that was going to matter in the long run for me, you know, because anything in the moment is difficult, but boy, it made a huge difference. And with that, we're just going to take a quick station break, Lily, before we move on with questions. You are listening to The Dirt on the Past with co-hosts Crystal Alegria and Nancy Mahoney on KGVM Bozeman or wherever you find your podcasts. We're speaking today with Dr. Lily White about her background in forensic anthropology and death work. So, Lily, we're big fans of Caitlin Daughtry. Is that how you say her last name?
Is that how you say it, Lily? Do you know?
Sure. I'm not sure.
Okay. I don't know.
Hopefully she's not listening. But she's amazing. First name Caitlin. And she has written When Smoke Gets in My Eyes, From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find the Good Death, and Will the Cat Eat My Eyeballs, which has to be one of my favorite titles ever for a book. So she is a woman who works in the funeral industry. She has often had, she often discusses that she's had an early fascination with death herself. She started as a mortician and then founded the Order of the Good Death, which is a death positive movement. you have somewhat of a similar philosophy on changing some of our standard practices, at least in this country, around death, and to make them more compassionate, including death notification interactions, as we've been discussing. So tell us a little bit more about this.
Well, I love her too. I follow her on Instagram, and I love, you know, the humor that she infuses and her videos and her, all of it. So I love when we can take something as difficult as death and sort of lighten it, and also, you know, sort of move it to something positive instead of the gloom and doom. And it was interesting. I do a lot of different conferences and panels, and so I was on a panel with a person that was studying transhumanism and death positive, and it was sort of I'd never heard of those things before, and I didn't really know what it was. And he was like, "Well, you're in the death positive movement," and I was like, "Well, am I?"
they drowned you in when you weren't looking.
Yeah. I was like, "Well, I'm going to have to look it up because I don't know what that is, and I'm also going to have to look up transhumanism, and you know, try to figure out what you're talking about." But I love Caitlin's you know, sort of the green deaths and
yes,
know,
I love that idea. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And celebrations. And I also love the idea of this whole new, it's not that new, but it's sort of new to me, is the death doulas. And you know, they're like a midwife, but they help you through death. And so I love that's happening, and that they help people die. And it's not just hospice, but it's, you know, people that need a little help dying, or they need a little help maybe talking to their families about dying, or right, making decisions about having a positive death, right, and making decisions about, you know, my here's how I want to experience my end of life. And, you know, sort of figuring out how to talk to families about dying, and how to bring it to a, you know, sort of a dining room conversation instead of, you know, no, we don't talk about that. And getting it away from, if we talk about it, doesn't mean it's going to happen. Right. If we talk about getting pregnant, doesn't mean you're going to get pregnant.
Oh,
you know,
and you're so, here. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
We all know, and we're going to die. We're not even all going to get pregnant, but we all are going to die.
Right. You know, and I love that those conversations are happening. I, you know, I sort of, like you say, been following this Caitlin, and then I have a lot of death doulas and everybody that I sort of keep track of, and, you know, sort of green burials. And and like you say, this death positive movement, I think is really good. And when I was doing my first degree, I was, you know, still kind of experimenting with death and the macabre. And I wrote a paper called Shot Before You Drop. You know, and it was just that, you know, sort of a humorous attempt at, you know, make some plans, talk to your family, you know, do those things. So we're all dying. So, you know, go shop it out. Don't leave it to your family to do your, you know, service or whatever after you're dead, when they're in that really difficult time where they can't make any decisions, or, you know, it's sad for them. So, and I was big on saying, you know, pick out your music, or if you want music, or if you want entertainers.
But it's actually a cultural practice you could change in a generation. You know, if people just start talking with their kids, with their families, really openly. I mean, we've gotten a lot more open about other things in this society, but it does seem like it could make the whole process and celebrations around it, or acknowledgement, much easier to deal with, and also could be something where you feel you have the support, because the person who's living could also be helped thinking, what would this person I might be leaving behind? Especially when you get a diagnosis, right? You don't want it to be like only then that you start thinking about it. So not to be macabre, but it would seem that if we were more engaged with all of this,
right,
it would come more naturally. Thanks for that. I think everyone should be reading Caitlin Daughtry's books.
That's
a great way to start.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we do the cemetery tours, a lot of times we do them with student groups as well. And a lot of times when I start the tour, the kids always are kind of jittery and they kind of always are like, oh, I don't want to go in the cemetery, you know, and I don't want to, it's scary in there, it's spooky, you know, and so that is something that I try to change as well, because that idea, you know, I think that's, that pretty much sums up what we think about death. It's scary, it's spooky, it's icky, we don't want to think about it, we don't want to deal with it, but it's really, it is, like you said, it's going to happen to everybody, and we do have to think about it, and we can think about it a little bit differently. So Lily, I want to kind of circle back around to what you do today, and I want to talk about what you've been doing more recently during this time of the pandemic with COVID. And you've spent some time in New York City working as a condolence specialist, helping COVID-19 patients' families in the New York City area through this recovery process. So can you talk a little bit more about this?
Yeah, I was deployed through Kenyan International Emergency Services to go help at the beginning of the pandemic. So it was in April of 2020.
Oh, wow.
And so when we didn't know what was happening, and our deaths at the time were 4,000 or, you know, whatever they were at the time. And so we didn't really know what we were walking into or how devastating this pandemic would be. And so, you know, I sort of wish I was more of a condolence person for the families, but what I ended up being was the person that picked up bodies. You know, collected bodies. I would go with a military team or, you know, people from our group, and we would just pick up bodies. And so sometimes the people were alone and had died at home, and so we would pick them up that way. Or sometimes we would encounter a few family members to a bunch of family members. And so, you know, that's what I did. And so it was a really interesting experience because, you know, I couldn't share it, and we couldn't really share it because of our clients. And so it was, pretty scary. And then to come home, you know, to Montana, and, people were like, oh, right, well, it's not going to happen, and it's fake, and it, you know, COVID's not real. And, you know, I said, well, it's coming, you know, from what we saw, it's coming, and it's not done with us, and it's absolutely going to spread. And, you know, at the time, I think people were thinking it just happened to old people, you know, this just happens to old people. Right. And I was not seeing that. And, what I was seeing was frightening. Mm. And, I just couldn't share it. I often think about if we could have shared the reality, if it would be as bad.
Really?
Wow. And, you know, think about that. And I think if people could have really been as freaked out as I was, or as freaked out as our team was, then it might not have been, it didn't have to be this way. Didn't have to be over 700,000 people dead. You know, it didn't have to be 2,300 Montanans so far dead. It didn't have to be this way. And so I often think about, because we weren't able to engage in those conversations, and we weren't able, you know, we had to keep it confidential. And I just wonder or think about how it might have been less death. And so that, it was tough.
Yeah.
It was a tough thing to do. And so, but I'm happy I did it. It was an amazing experience, and, you know, people were wonderful, and so really good team to work with. And
wow. Yeah. You know, it just makes me think of, you know, we're living through historic times, of course, with this pandemic. But when you talk about that, you know, it reminds me of the yellow fever epidemics of the 1700s in our country, you know. So we often are on this day-to-day basis just living this life, but really we're going through these epic scenarios that you just described and that we read about and are horrified by, and you went through that. It's
well, hard to grapple, I'm sure. A lot about I think about like smallpox or whatever, yeah. and I think about because it expressed itself on the outside that you could actually see the smallpox. Mm-hmm. I thought, you know, COVID, you couldn't see it. So, you know, it, I don't know if people just didn't or don't take it seriously because it's not expressed mm-hmm. in the body or that, you know, I don't know, but I often think of, you know, smallpox and things like that where, you know, you could see it and there it was.
Well, that must have been a very hard time for you. So, but I'm sure those families were so grateful for your work and what you did there. So I want to change directions a little bit again and talk about something that you teach about, which is dark tourism, which kind of revolves into everything that we're talking about today, you know, and I've been talking about our cemetery tours that we're doing that are so popular right now because people just love dark tourism. They love murder and mayhem. And of course, our most popular walking tour is Murders, Madams, and Mediums. And so what brings people to this? You know, why does tragedy attract people? And why do we as humans have to experience this and think about this and go, like, spend money to be horrified? What is it within us?
Well, you know, and I think that is, you know, sort of the question. And I think it changes. And I think it comes down to people's motivation at the time. And, you know, you can look at some people have just sort of a general fascination with death. And so they show up and they're interested. Or you find that these types of things or these types of tours or adventures or tourism is because people know and value the person, the decedent, or somebody that's died. So you see the, you know, people flocking to Kurt Cobain's house in Seattle or, you know, Paris where Princess Diana wrecked, you know, and so they have an emotional response to a site. And so they connect with that site. Or, you know, there's also another, you know, sort of element, which is sort of a collective place identity. So it could be either cultural, political, religious, those different values where people will go to a particular cemetery or, you know, a battlefield or whatever. And so, you know, I just watched the show the other day on the Civil War, you know, and people going to different battlefields or whatever. And so it can be a number of different reasons. Another one is sometimes educational, like you guys is, mm-hmm. or experiential. Mm-hmm. We went to DC to the Holocaust Museum, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and, you know, you sort of become, you have a card and you become sort of that person, whoever's card you get. And so it's that experience and, you know, it's tied to the, you know, this atrocity that happened. And so it brings you, you know, it's a guided tour and it brings you through these emotions things like that. So educational, it's an experience, or then you have commemoration or commodification. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times I'll go to a place and I want the t-shirt. You know,
I'm with you on that. Yeah.
yeah. Or, right. You know, I mean, if the right people set something up, I mean, you go for, maybe you show up and you sleep in the bedroom where Lizzie Borden's, you know, stepmom got butchered, mm-hmm. and it comes with a, you know, I survived the night in, you know, the bedroom. Or, you know, you go on a walking tour of Jack the Ripper, you know, where did he go? And, you know, and you come home with a t-shirt, or you come home with the pictures, or, you know, it's also to be able to share this with our social media. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody loves a provocative Instagram, mm-hmm. you know, and what's more provocative than death? And sex, but if you could do the two,
right. kittens are sometimes out, yeah. though, I don't know, like animal, baby animals, but we can get back to death and sex. That's fine.
Right. Right. I'm the one that likes all of the Rex Chapman's dog, silly dog things. But no, but I think it, you know, it's sort of being provocative too. Mm. You know, it's like, ooh, I want, you know, I want the most likes or going viral, or, you know, how weird can this be? Or,
yeah, right.
You know, but I think it just depends on sort of the person and what they want to get out of it. And I think very few people go to, you know, cemetery or a battlefield or whatever, just to be a bystander.
I think we have to start doing TikToks in the cemetery, Crystal. Yeah. I think this might be the way to kind of like, I mean, everybody's all about that pug noodles. Like, is it a bones day or no bones day? Which might be very appropriate for our conversation with you. But like, maybe we need to come up with a version of that for cemetery tour.
Oh, man.
Now I'm going to watch.
That might be on the edge. I don't know.
I don't know. I think if we rope in the young people to help us, they'll figure it out. So Lily, this has been such a fascinating discussion today, and I just want to ask one last question. You and your husband Stocky White, who is an archaeologist, you have your own consulting company, as we mentioned, Bone and Stone Anthrosciences, which is a great name, and you provide anthropological and archaeological consulting services and workshops. So I wondered if you could tell us when your next one might be, or what it might be about, and sort of let people know if they are interested, what something like a workshop with you guys would look like.
Well, I do a couple webinars, and so I have a webinar coming up, and it's called Bone or Stone, Human or Non-Human. And it's a 2-hour webinar, and I've set it up mostly for sort of crime scene law enforcement, or people that just want to, you know, take the course.
But, do you teach them to lick the bone to see if it sticks to your tongue? Otherwise, it's a stone.
That's one of the questions on the test.
I know that, I'm just an archaeologist, so I feel pretty good about that.
I'm like, don't you lick it, especially the crime scene people. I'm like, do not lick it.
Do not
lick
it.
And why would you not lick it?
Well, there's a DNA issue there. Yeah, but usually when we're in the field, we're like, yeah, you could lick it. Like, if you don't know which bucket to throw it in. And students are like, really? We're like, really?
You know, the fun part is that, like, archaeologists do that a lot. You know, that it's like, well, you know, it's just, you know, stone or whatever. Well, these people that I'm teaching are crime scene.
Yeah.
You know, they're like,
Yeah, you know? It's completely totally different. Yes, it should be. Yep.
Right. So I have that one, and then I have the one coming up with Dr. Parsons in San Diego, and so we just try to keep it fresh, and, you know, try to keep it exciting, and I'm creating a couple different ones, and I think Stock and I will create a couple together that we can, I can use his, you know, arc powers, and I'll use my death, dying, and bone powers. But he's really busy. He works for FEMA. And so he works in the dining room, and I work over here.
All FEMA related business goes into the dining area.
right. He's totally taken over the dining room. So he doesn't get out very much. And so mostly the clients are sort of my,
I see your end. Got it. He's got other work, contract work.
Yeah. He likes it, and sort of, you know, looks at my paper and peeks over the side.
Sees what you're up to. Well, that's great. Well, thank you so much, Lily. I think it's so important that we really, you know, start to engage closer with death and dying. And your work is so fascinating. So thanks for talking about it with us today. We so enjoyed it.
Thank you.
We're so grateful. Yeah, it's been such a pleasure. I hope we have you on again, and you might see us popping into one of your webinars one of these times. So thank you, and thanks to all our listeners out there for joining us today. If you love this podcast, please tell a friend and make sure to subscribe so it shows up in your podcast feed each week. And consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, but only if it's a positive review.
Right.
Thanks for listening today, and we hope you can join us again to find out more about
the dirt on the past.
So a big thank you also to our editor and sound guru, Steve Durbin. Thanks to Lawson Alegria for the amazing music, and to John Chadwell for help getting this podcast out into the world. Thanks, everyone.